Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Megan Watson. I have worked in the functional neurological disorders field for a decade, using my background in neuroscience, mental health, business, and healthcare administration. I currently serve as the program director of the FND program at the University of Colorado in the U.S., and I founded and chair the FND Society Pediatric Special Interest Group, as well as co-author Reset and Rewire, the FND Workbook for Kids and Teens. Our discussion today is part of a podcast series, Are Children Small Adults? And in today's episode, we will talk about functional neurological disorder in children and adults. My guests today are Dr. Pavlina Denhofer and Dr. Natalia Shako. Dr. Denhofer is an associate professor and pediatric neurologist at the University of Brno, Czech Republic. She serves as e-learning liaison of the EAN-FND panel and has developed an FND clinic for children. She is specialized in FND as well as rare and genetic neurodevelopmental disorders. Dr. Shako is a neurologist and board member of the European Society for the Study of Tourette Syndrome and also a child neurology panel member of the EAN. She is working at the Medical University of Warsaw and Specialized Psychiatric Center at Łódź, Poland, and is specialized in movement disorders, mainly tics and functional movement disorders, but also neuropsychiatry. Welcome to you both, and thank you for joining us today.
Hello, thank you for having us.
Hello.
The first question I have for you both involves definitions. You know, although FND is a highly prevalent condition, it does remain widely underrecognized and often goes ignored in everyday practice. Dr. Denhofer, could you please provide a definition of FND?
Yes. It's quite difficult to make a brief definition, but we can say that easily, a functional neurological disorder is a condition in which a person experiences abnormal function in a system that can be shown to be normal. It means that the system, organ or limb, briefly, has impaired function, but the patient does not have control over it. Normally, we explain it to patients like it's that there is a software error in a normal hardware function.
Absolutely, yes. So difficult to define. Thank you so much. And Dr. Shako, wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how FND is diagnosed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah, thank you so much, Pavlina, also for giving this definition. And it's true that, you know, I think that recently we are trying to sort of highlight that, of course, it's a disorder of, you know, functioning of the, but on the other hand, new biomarkers are showing that actually patients with FND, they also have some changes, you know, in neurotransmission. So we are learning more and more, but especially for children and parents, I think it's great that we have this possibility to use this metaphor of software and hardware. But yes, in terms of the diagnosis, this also changed a lot recently. So before, you know, and probably everybody, each neurologist, you know, we remember these times where all these patients, they were coming with all these different investigations made and, you know, to exclude all these other disorders. But now, actually, to diagnose FND, we consider it's a rule-in diagnosis. So we diagnose this on the positive signs, based on the positive signs, and there, which means that there are specific signs in neurological exam in the patient's history that help us to diagnose FND. For example, you know, coming from the, again, movement disorders field and like especially tic specialists. So we know that if a child has a sudden onset of tics, I don't know, at age of 15, it's highly unlikely that it's Tourette syndrome. By like 90% of Tourette patients, they start with tics before the age of 12. So if the onset is sudden at later age than 12, you know, then you already start thinking, okay, this is like a red flag for FND. Or, for example, in a patient with seizures, if the patient has this side-to-side head movements and like a very strong closure of the eyes and the episodes are very long, then you also think, okay, this is maybe not a seizure, but a well, there is also a discussion about a dissociative seizure or, you know, because we are moving also. This is another interesting conversation, the names, right, that we are using. But anyway, so, or in the paresis, there are some specific signs that are showing that maybe it's not due to stroke, but it's a functional paresis. So we call, for example, a Hoover sign. So in other words, now it's a ruling diagnosis is a positive based on positive signs, not that you have to conduct, you know, all, exclude all other diseases and at the end it's FND. No, I really encourage the neurologist to check all this and signs and ask this history is a key here too.
Absolutely. Yep. Those clinical signs and, of course, the clinical story. Dr. Danhofer, Dr. Shako mentioned that FND shows up, you know, all across the neurology clinic. Would you mind telling us about the most prevalent clinical phenotypes of FND?
I think as we talk about children or adults, there is not a big difference in the general group of FNDs. Briefly, they can be classified according to the system they affect of the nervous system. So mostly we see functional movement disorders, as Natalia said already, functional tremor, functional myoclonus, functional dystonia with its specific features. Very often in children, we can also see functional limb weakness or a functional gait disturbance. This is quite often, especially in epilepsy centers, we meet functional seizures, which are very common there. And they are really interesting from the point of differential diagnosis. Sometimes it's quite difficult to differentiate between epileptic and non-epileptic seizure or functional seizure. And then not so commonly, but also seen are functional sensory symptoms in general, visual symptoms, functional speech or cognitive disorders, functional dizziness, or anything you can imagine in the nervous system. Together with neurological signs, we do not have to overlook comorbidities in these patients like depression or features of anxiety, which are very sometimes overlooked, but very important from the point of quality of life. Also, these patients all very often refer very subtle problems when you compare them with the neurological signs. But for example, some chronic pelvic pain, irritable bowel syndrome, or anything. So really they can be very complex and we should not concentrate only on the neurological sign, but look widely in the range of symptoms the patient can have.
Absolutely. And I think, at least in the adult literature, which we do have a little bit more data on adults with FNDs than peds, we do see that it's generally around 1 in 4 that show up to an outpatient neurology clinic will have some sort of FND symptom. So again, quite a highly prevalent condition. But let's go ahead and come to the main topic of our podcast. Dr. Shako, does the phenomenology of FND differ between children and adults?
Yeah, well, it's a quite a difficult question because unfortunately it's as you all know, at least my co-speakers and Pavlina and Megan, you are also working with children, that it's highly understudied topic unfortunately at the moment, and we are learning about it. But well, some preliminary data, you know, really preliminary, and it's very scarce literature, is showing that maybe, well, but I'm just telling you that it's, you know, only based on very limited data, that in children, well, it seems that the phenotype generally, you know, it's more the phenomenology and the onset is more abrupt. I mean, it could be also in adults, but even more in children and more even related to stressors. than in adults. In adults, it seems that it could be more insidious. And therefore, well, we will come to the prognosis, but also it has to do with the prognosis that also generally in children, it has better prognosis. Of course, I'm talking about, you know, this is a general assumptions. And again, from the preliminary literature, it seems that, as Pavlina mentioned, almost every symptom can be a neurological symptom, could be an FND related. But it seems that in children, especially these motor symptoms, such as movement disorders, functional tics, or this limb weakness, it seems that it's one of the predominant phenotypes. Well, then it's followed by these dissociative seizures. In adults, it seems that, at least from my clinical also experience, it's often an overlap with different, you know. At the end, it's true that many of our patients, also children, they have also an overlay of different symptoms. For example, one of my patients, she had first functional tic-like behaviors, then she had dissociative seizures, then also functional mutism. So, you know, it's often changes. But yeah, that would be at least what we know at the moment from the literature. But it's not clear. What we do know, I would say, is that generally, like I said, in terms of the prognosis, I would say that in children and adolescents, in general, it's better than in, you know, older adults taking together. But I think we will talk also about it. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. We will dive into prognosis here in a minute, but let's focus on children a bit more. Dr. Danhofer, what do we know about the onset of FND? Dr. Shako mentioned a little bit, but about the onset in children, when do these FND symptoms typically present for them? And are there any differences when we're looking at sex and gender?
Mm-hmm. I think that there are quite good epidemiological data that we have two peaks of incidence of FND. One peak is adolescence. It means around 12 to 16 years. And I think that most of patients manifest their clinical symptoms in this age. And then another peak is in adulthood. This is not my domain, but I will talk about children. But there are also some exceptions. We have also younger children. The youngest we have is around 5 years old, but they are really rare in this age group. So really it's adolescence. And I think it's connected with the developmental aspect of this period. In the life, it means hormones predominantly in women, of course, and also the conflict in this age with growing up and taking responsibility for its own personality.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And same question to you, Dr. Shako, but if you don't mind focusing on adults this time. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I can only echo what Pavlina said. So that generally, you know, we have these two peaks, and it's true that in adults, it's generally this younger adults, I would say, you know, between 30 and 40. This is like the you know, epidemiological studies are showing this. And then, yes, there are another interesting finding, but we at the moment don't really understand. And I think it's even... Well, it's the same in children and in adolescents, that it's more predominant in females, but we really don't know why. I mean, here I can only encourage our listeners first to, there will be another podcast about biological sex differences that will be part of the FND-related podcasts of European Academy of Neurology. And we have also the sex and gender group in the Functional Neurological Disorders Society, where I'm fortunate to be involved also in. So generally, there we are trying to find out why really this female predominance, because really don't know. It's true that it could be due to hormones, but it's also not clear, or to some, you know, biological differences. But it could be that there is also some kind of implicit historical bias, unfortunately, meaning that we are just more inclined to diagnose, females with FND because of this, historical background of Charcot, who was saying also this is hysteria. And then other point is that maybe males, on the other hand, they are not as frequently, they don't want to go to doctors with this kind of problems. They just ignore it, or they are ignored maybe. The same for boys, So it's an interesting topic, this intersection between biological and social and biases that we are all involved in. So I really encourage if somebody is interested in this topic. And another thing is that what Pavlina mentioned, this FND in very small children, which is rare, but why it occurs, in my opinion, from my experience at least, it's usually you should search for a trigger there on the family dynamics or unfortunately some kind of interfamiliar problem or, well, rarely at this group, at this age group, also somewhere in the school environment, but more, I would say, in the family. And then also FND in elderly people, this is another interesting topic understudied. Mainly, summarizing, we have these two peaks, and in adults, these all younger adults, and again, this female predominance, but like I said, we don't really know. And just to wrap up, one more thing interesting is that, we have another interesting discussion about gender minorities. There are some preliminary data and the research in this field showing that maybe it's more prevalent in FND than in general sort of society. But again, it's understudied and we don't really understand it at the moment.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say, Dr. Shakil, that the data is coming, very small studies on the sex and gender minorities in this population. But let's shift to pathophysiology. So the pathophysiology of FND, I think for even neurologists, can be quite complex to explain. And despite small studies showing functional MRI changes in the brains of those who have FND compared to controls, we still don't know enough about this disorder. So if both of you could speak on the pathophysiologic model for FND and whether we know if there are differences between a child who has FND versus an adult. We'll start with Dr. Shakil.
So yeah, you're absolutely right that on the one hand, actually we wrote an interesting systematic review about this topic, biomarkers of FND. It's really fascinating. On one hand, we don't really know a lot yet, but we learned a lot already. I think that generally speaking, we can say that we like at the beginning, Pavlina said that we know that. And suspect, and we know from the neuroimaging that it's a disorder that is involved in the control of the motor system and the control of the movement. But and then that these people, that patients with FND, the neuroimaging studies are showing that, on the other hand, in neuroimaging, but not only neuroimaging, that there is also a pattern of, alexithymia, so lack of sometimes understanding of emotions and the also interception, so of understanding of what my own body is doing. And we are, thanks to this, understanding of pathophysiology, we are developing new treatments because that are helpful for our patients, because then the patients, we can use it to improve this interception. More recently, we're also learning that stress and stress pathways are also very important in development of FND. This is a complex topic too, because on the other hand, not every patient, and this is I want to really highlight, not every patient or child with FND has a clear stressor or like a trauma. That's at least I hear this constantly, that sometimes we are searching for like huge trauma, but sometimes, well, it depends. The definition of trauma or stress is different for each person. But I would say that, these are the highlights. But then with more recently, even genetic background is investigated by markers of, like I said, stress, but also even inflammatory biomarkers also. But I would say that the most important is the execution of movement, the control of the movement, this alexithymia interoception and the stress regulatory pathway. At least from my experience, I think, and a little bit what I know from the literature, the models by Kasia Kozłowska, who is very involved in the pediatric FND, it's more in children, you know, more related to the stress and this kind of, you know, pathophysiological background, even more than in adults, in my opinion. But again, this is like very preliminary. We don't really have a comparison at the moment, a clear data. I don't know, Pavlina, do you want to add something?
I'm just thinking about what you have said. Yes, I agree. I think easily said, it's just a neural network problem. It's very complex. It's connected with interoception, exteroception, and emotions. It's connected with stress, especially in children, I agree. The stress is not the main thing there. Of course, we have FND after infection, FND after trauma, anything. So patients usually have fear that they we send them to the psychiatrist, easily saying, and they have problem with this. But we can see that our patients, especially adolescents, are very sensitive personalities, normally functioning, but quite special in coping with stress, pain, and working or functioning in the environment among their friends, school, parents, families. So they are just, in my opinion, they are just more sensitive, and they have some predisposition for this disease, but they are not like just connected with the psychological status. And I think genetics is very important there also, because we have families where functional neurological disorders are affected in siblings or parents or grandparents. So they are together with this symptomatology. But we are not still sure about one gene, of course. We cannot just identify one gene, but they are polygenetic, maybe just some personality traits which are written in the genome. So we don't know. We don't know. It's very complex, but I agree with everything that it's complex. Neural network system disease.
Absolutely. And I would encourage our listeners that, yes, you know, we don't yet know as much as we need to know about this diagnosis, but it is absolutely real. It is absolutely involuntary. And when you take care of these patients, they get better. And so let's dive in a bit about prognosis. Dr. Danhofer, if you wouldn't mind telling us a bit about the prognosis of FND and whether or not that differs between adults and children.
Concerning the prognosis, we have some traits which are talking for better prognosis in our patients. And generally, we can say that the main positive prognostic factors are early diagnosis and early treatment, of course, in children. And also younger age of manifestation, because I think that we use the plasticity of the brain, and when the disease is diagnosed in smaller children, the prognosis is better. And of course, also the access to the medical care is very important in terms of prognosis. And negative prognostic factors are the opposite, of course. But still, I wouldn't say there is some difference between children and adults. But one thing is important, and I was talking about it already, it's the possibility we have in children, the possibility to influence the developing brain. We are working with adolescents mostly, and or smaller children, and they have a great potential of plasticity of the brain, and we can influence a lot of patterns of behavior, coping with pain or stressful situations. And this allows us better work with these children, better reactions to the therapy, and adaptation to FND symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally agree. And even, you know, we conducted a study about, sorry, again, repetitive a little bit, but functional tick-like behaviors. And, you know, we had a cohort of patients, well, obviously, again, mainly these movements, they started in adolescence, but also in some adults. And, you know, when comparing the prognosis in these patients through, well, it was, you know, a longitudinal study of 1 year, we could see really that yeah, exactly what Pavlina said, that in these younger, in teenagers, it was better. Many of them, they even improved after the psychoeducation, you know, spontaneously, sort of without any intervention at all. But it was not, unfortunately, at least from our study, again, all these studies are preliminary. It seems that it was worse in adults. But I agree with Pavlina, it doesn't necessarily mean that if you are an adult with FND, your prognosis is bad. It's just that it's a little bit, you know, we are talking about statistical probabilities. And again, the small data sample. But totally, I would say that the same prognostic factors are true for adults. So the longer you wait with the diagnosis, the longer is this diagnostic odyssey. Like I had a patient who, you know, with dissociative seizures, and he had been diagnosed with drug-resistant epilepsy and 5 medications until he came to me, and I'm like, okay, no, these are not seizures, but dissociative seizures. Like, you don't need these medications. And, you know, obviously for this patient, he took like 2 years to get this done. So it's worse than for a patient who would have this as a rule in diagnosis with the positive signs at the very beginning. But unfortunately, you know, I think that it's also important to mention that the use of this additional aids, sometimes it could be a prognostic factor. So I had a patient who was using the wheelchair already from the beginning, you know, like a severity of the disease and disability is another important prognostic factor. But again, don't lose hope. If you're listening to this and you have FND and you're using AIDS, there is hope. We can definitely, there is treatment. It's just statistical probabilities.
Absolutely. And I think the one of the most important things that you both said was that the delay to diagnosis affects that prognosis. So making sure that our listeners understand that getting patients at least to some sort of treatment is potentially the most important thing that they can do. So let's talk a bit about treatment. Dr. Danhofer, what are some of the basic treatment approaches for FND and do they differ across adults and children?
I don't think there is some difference again between children and adults in treatment approaches, but of course children are not just small adults, and the thing is that when we treat the child, we also treat the whole family. We treat parents also and siblings. And the opposite, because when you are a pediatrician, you are used to talk to parents. The child is sitting there, but you are talking to parents. But here, there is, I think, a very specific situation, and we should concentrate on the child, because the child, the patient, is very important in the process of therapy. And the child has to be involved entirely in the therapeutic approach and take responsibility for it. And I think this is another example of the process of developing brain and taking responsibility for the adult life, which is very important here in this adolescent life. And it works very well, because when the child can see that you count on him, you talk to him, you take the responsibility of the disease, which is in his own hands, it increases the cooperation between the child and the doctor or therapeutist. And on the other hand, also, as I said in the beginning, parents are very important, because if the parents don't accept the diagnosis, it can't work. The child is usually coping the attitude of parents and the approach of parents. So if they do not accept the diagnosis, the child doesn't cooperate. So it's a complex view on the diagnosis and treatment, which has to involve not only the patient, but the whole family. I think this is very important. And as Natalia said already, alexithymia can be very disturbing in the therapeutic process and is very often seen in our patients, because if they are emotionally disconnected from their symptoms, they do not cooperate. So sometimes it's very difficult to get the motivation of the child for the treatment.
Yeah, I can totally agree. And I think it's very important, and it's similar in adults and children, that we should focus on first on psychoeducation, often with the caregiver. You know, if it's an adult, then involve the caregiver too. In my opinion, we should remember always about this biopsychosocial modeling, right? When you think about the factors, okay, this person has a predisposition, biological, but then which psychological factors are contributing to maybe to the disease, and then which sociological factors could be promoting this. And then I totally agree that, you know, yes, in adults, you know, you should take into account obviously the caregiver, also the relatives, the work, but then the children. Yes, exactly, the parents. And I try to do the approach based on the child, based on the family, and then based on the school, because sometimes the reaction in the school is also important, you know. How do they develop? And we did a beautiful work at FNDS pediatric group, you know, this response packages that you can give to its school to help people, so that the teachers, they know how to react, for example, for during dissociative seizure. So, you know, I think that that this is crucial. And again, I guess everybody who is interested in FND knows this. And I guess it's sort of comes from as a self-explanatory after this episode, that it's a multidisciplinary approach. Like, you cannot do this alone. You really need a, you know, this perspective and background and expertise of different experts to really treat your patient and really help the patient. Yeah.
Yes, yes, the school is very important. I agree. I think that sometimes the school can make a big problem with the treatment if they don't accept it and they don't cooperate with us. So it's not very rare that we really call to the school, talk to teachers or director of the school, because these children or these patients are very specific, and the attitude of school is still very negative in general, I would say.
A lot of clear communication, a lot of setting expectations, a lot of stakeholders to take care of in this population. So often you need that neurology champion, which of course you both are, and hopefully others who are listening fill that role as well. So last few questions here. Let's talk about the topic of transition. Dr. Shako, what struggles have you experienced when you are referring a child to adult care or potentially receiving a child from another institution or physician?
Especially in FND fields, unfortunately, it sort of became a hot topic generally in pediatric neurology, the transition of care. But I think that, you know, for FND, it's very hard, because we just, in the whole world, we're just starting to build at the FND clinics, and there is no clear, you know, pathway of transitioning. For me, maybe it's a little bit easier, because like I actually came from the adults to children. I got interested, you know, from the adult world to children. So, and I have now, I'm fortunate to see also children. And in my institution, basically we are also fortunate that we have child psychiatrists and psychiatrists. So, you know, and neurologists. So we have this multidisciplinarity too, and it's great then, but unfortunately it's not always the case. I think that the future, you know, is the multidisciplinary. It's really the creation of clinics where the neurologists and psychiatrists and psychologists and occupational therapists and all these different and physiotherapists are working together. But yes, I think that at least, you know, depending on this very geographical differences, but The biggest challenges, like I said, I'm very fortunate, but the biggest challenges I think is that exactly the approaches are different of the people who are working with children, have experience with children, and then adult neurologists. For example, I think, again, coming from the adult field, that often, unfortunately, we ignore, you know, the environment, we ignore the family or caregivers. So if I can just make this opportunity to just remind my colleagues and that we should take into account these contributing factors and the importance of environment and the family and the caregivers and the other factors that sometimes, you know, I think that generally people working with children, they pay more attention to this.
Absolutely, Dr. Shiko. And Dr. Danhofer, if you don't mind commenting on that and then leading us into a little bit about your program and clinical pathway, that would be great.
Yeah, I can add something. In my opinion, the transition care in this broader sense of meaning starts in the outpatient clinics, in child neurologists or neurologists who work with the whole sort of patients with neurological symptoms and diseases, because if they accept the diagnosis, and we still fight with this, I think in general, if they accept the diagnosis and if they increase the awareness of how to handle these patients, because I think that in outpatient clinics, in terrain, how we say in our country, there is no space and possibility to treat these patients. We need FND clinics because we need the multidisciplinary team, of course. But if these patients are recognized early in the whole country and are referred to the centers, as we said already, the early diagnosis, the better prognosis. So if we start there, we can increase the better prognosis in the centers, and it will be more fluent, of course, the treatment, the transition and everything. So I think we are quite far from transition care, but we should start with awareness about the disease. And as we talk about our center, I work in the child's hospital. We have a child FND center, but together with another hospital in our town, we take care for children who are adults or who grow up to adults. So the transition care is working on some friendship, I would say, between the doctors. Because we know each other, we are just few who treat these patients, and we communicate, we talk together, we meet together, and we are able to make the transition fluent in these patients, because there are not hundreds of these patients, I would say. In children, we have dozens of patients, and we are able to make the fluent transition to adult clinic. But I think that we need more FND clinics, more specialists, and more awareness in the field.
Absolutely. And hopefully this podcast is one way to get there. Thank you both so much for joining today, and thank everyone who is listening. We are so excited to speak about one of our favorite topics today. And I know that Dr. Danhofer and Dr. Shiko would be open to any sort of follow-up questions should you have them after listening to this. So thank you all for doing this, and look forward to seeing you again soon.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.